Welcome back to Meet the Professors, and we continue with our program. Dr. Hendricks, can you present your patient?
Okay. This is a 27-year-old Ashkenazi Jewish woman presented with a palpable breast mass. She had a striking family history of breast cancer with multiple women affected with early age onset disease, but several of the affected had been tested and no known mutation was identified in the family. When she was surgically staged, she had a 3-centimeter grade 2 invasive ductal cancer associated with extensive DCIS with adequate margins at the time of lumpectomy and 3 negative sentinel nodes. Receptor positive, HER2 strongly positive with a FISH copy number of 8.1, ratio 8.1. And she was systemically staged and had no metastatic disease, and she came for a discussion about adjuvant therapy. She's a single at the age of 27 and not partnered and desirous of future childbearing. She was accompanied by both of her parents.
So, Peter, we have the concern here about future fertility.
Well, there is some data in the literature that suggests that ovarian suppression before chemotherapy can protect ovarian function for later. So that's something to be considered. The probability that she'll become infertile because of the chemotherapy is hard to gauge, but most 27-year-olds will start menstruating afterwards. If you look at the MD Anderson series, in which they took a look to see outcomes for patients who became pregnant after breast cancer and whether or not that worsened their prognosis, somehow whether or not the special hormonal milieu of pregnancy encouraged breast cancer recurrence, that it didn't have a deleterious effect. So this is a patient who might well decide to have ovarian suppression done. And such ovarian suppression would have both an anti-breast cancer effect, essentially getting reversible LHRH analog rather than oophorectomy. And also, given the fact that she's got a T2 tumor, she should consider getting chemotherapy as well.
What about trastuzumab?
I think trastuzumab would be a good option for this woman.
Do you think this woman might have been willing to risk or potentially compromise her therapy to retain her fertility?
It was a little difficult situation, a very young woman with both parents and maybe the mother being a little more proactive in terms of the fertility issue.
Right.
So, Peter, exactly what chemo, trastuzumab, hormonal regimen would you give her or recommend to her?
Well, I should actually go back and say one thing, and that is that we don't know this for a fact, but it is possible that by shutting down ovarian function that we could compromise the effectiveness of the chemotherapy. And so if she were ER negative, we wouldn't be concerned about this, but she's got the kind of conflicting forces here. Now, the trial that showed that basically hormonal therapy concurrent with chemotherapy was a bad idea was a trial done in postmenopausal women with tamoxifen. And so that trial doesn't really completely bear on her case, but you'd have to tell her that usually you wouldn't actually cause ovarian suppression purposefully before or concurrently with the chemotherapy. I think that this patient should be treated pretty much as has been done in the intergroup trastuzumab trial, and that is that this woman would be a good woman to receive an anthracycline-based regimen followed by a taxane-based regimen, starting concurrently at that point with trastuzumab, Herceptin.
What type of hormonal therapy?
There really are two strategies. One of them is if she really wanted to minimize her risk of becoming infertile, I think that she might consider the possibility of starting an LHRH analog along with the chemotherapy. There are ongoing studies looking at whether or not that might help, but they're being done in ER-negative patients where it wouldn't confound the effects of chemotherapy. After her therapy is complete, I think she could either take tamoxifen or an LHRH suppression if that's what she wants to do at that point. And she should get that therapy for 5 years.
And if she chose the LHRH agonist, would you add in an AI?
I wouldn't. You know, that's a clinical trial question. And I am concerned that there are osseous issues in a young woman of that kind of complete suppression. What the long-term effects of giving people IV bisphosphonates to protect bone, whether or not that might cause some kind of long-term issues that we don't really recognize at this point. So given the fact that I don't see convincing evidence from any source that combined ovarian ablation and AI increases efficacy, and because of uncertainties about the safety of it in the long term, I would actually think ovarian ablation would be the right thing to do.
George, let's talk a little bit about adjuvant trastuzumab. First, this lady is node negative. A lot of questions are out there in terms of trastuzumab for patients who are node negative, particularly those who are ER positive. Can you talk about what was seen in the trials, which trials looked at this and what was seen?
Well, first, we have those trials where trastuzumab was not used in node-negative patients. So, for instance, the NSCBP B31 trial was a lymph node-positive trial. N9831 originally was a lymph node-positive trial, but was amended fairly far along to allow lymph node-negative patients. In the event, about 11 or 12% of patients who went on to that trial were lymph node-negative patients. The HERA trial, the large international, largely European trial, that gave trastuzumab following chemotherapy, allowed lymph node negative patients from the beginning, and roughly a third of the patients who went into that trial were lymph node negative. So we have that entire spectrum there from only lymph node positive to a substantial number of patients who are lymph node negative. The HERA trial certainly shows the same proportional reduction in lymph node negative patients as it does in lymph node positive patients. The numbers are way too small in the joint analysis to be able to say with any convincing certainty that they're equivalent, but we have no particular reason to believe that it wouldn't be. When we say that this is a lymph node negative patient, this is a lymph node negative patient with a 3-centimeter tumor. A 3-centimeter tumor is stage 2 breast cancer. It has the same prognosis as a woman who has a 1.5-centimeter tumor with 1 or 2 positive lymph nodes. And we would have absolutely no issue whatsoever about giving adjuvant trastuzumab to that patient, so I'd see no reason why we'd have any concerns about giving adjuvant trastuzumab to this patient. The data that we have from all of the trials suggests that trastuzumab is a benefit in both estrogen receptor negative and estrogen receptor positive patients with similar proportional reductions in the hazard rates, regardless of steroid receptor status, so that would not influence me as to whether or not to give trastuzumab in this patient.
What about the smaller node-negative tumors, 1 to 2 centimeters or even less than 1 centimeter?
Well, we really don't know. I personally have not treated women typically who are HER2-positive with tumors less than 1 centimeter. But certainly tumors between 1 and 2 centimeter were allowed onto the HERA trial. What we've not had to date, and that's because the HERA trial has relatively little follow-up and therefore relatively fewer events, is any real breakdown to give us some sense of what degree of benefit that will be achieved. My suspicion is that, as we've said for adjuvant trial modalities in the past, is that we're likely to get the same proportional reduction across all groups in HER2-positive patients. But the question is not so much whether or not we get a similar proportional reduction, but what is the absolute benefit versus what's the risk that the patient faces in the way of toxicity. And one could easily imagine that there are going to be subpopulations of patients who have relatively smallish lymph node negative tumors where the absolute risk of recurrence would be relatively less and where, based, for instance, on things such as age or prior cardiac history, the risk might be substantially greater. And I think we just simply don't have enough data yet to know what those trade-offs are yet.
Peter, this woman or this woman's mother says, I've been out on the internet and I see that there are a couple different kinds of chemotherapy that are used. One is the AC followed by taxane and the other is the TCH. Any difference in terms of effects on fertility?
I don't know the answer to that question.
George?
Well, we don't know, though platinating agents certainly can affect fertility. I think that's well known. The extent to which it affects fertility in the BCRG06 trial has not been reported. But it wouldn't surprise you if carb tax in some way diminished the fertility of a premenopausal woman.
The presentation by Dennis Slaman at the San Antonio meeting in December of the BCRG006 trial, the fascinating part of it was looking at the TOPO2. Can you talk about what was presented there and what your take is on that?
Sure. Well, if you look at the biology of HER2, HER2 is located on the long arm of chromosome 17. In an area where topoisomerase 2 is also located. And topo 2 is probably the main biologic target for anthracyclines. If you look at HER2-positive patients, about a third of those patients also have amplification of topo 2 because they are fairly close together and because the amplicons can overlap. Some patients don't have amplification. Some patients, in fact, have deletion of topo 2. But about a third of the patients have co-amplification of topo 2 along with HER2. The data that was presented by the BCIRG and Dennis Slaman on their behalf suggest, and I say suggest because I don't think we have sufficient follow-up and because the numbers clearly are not significant enough for at least one of the subset analyses, suggests that if you have co-amplification of HER2 and TOPO2, that's probably the population of patient that needs an anthracycline in the setting of HER2-positive disease. And that it may well be, and again, with lots of qualifiers here because we have smallish number of events and relatively short follow-up, it may well be that if you don't have co-amplification of TOPO2-alpha with HER2, you probably get along quite fine with a non-anthracycline-based regimen. I view this as fascinating biology. It makes sense to me based on what we know about the biology of HER2 and TOPO2, but again, with the huge qualification that this is a single study, very short follow-up, fairly small numbers, and we would certainly like to have more data than we've got today.
Peter?
I would agree with George, absolutely. I think that the thing to say about TOPO2 is that the idea that TOPO2 expression might actually identify a group of patients that particularly were sensitive to anthracyclines has been out there for a while, and the literature is very muddy, and that's because up until this point, most of the studies have been done with immunohistochemistry. The nice thing about the BCRG study is that it was done with fluorescence in situ hybridization, which is less subjective than immunohistochemistry is. But I think that it's one study, and it'll be interesting to see if that result can be replicated in other studies, because it would be very useful to be able to identify which patients were particularly likely to benefit from an anthracycline.
If I could add just a brief historical note, in 2000, the NCI held a consensus development conference on adjuvant therapy, and there was a pro and con session. I think you were pro and I was con, on whether or not we should use HER2 to define which population of patients receives anthracyclines.
I remember that.
And it's interesting that 6 years later, we actually finally have a study that probably as well as any study ever actually allows us to specifically answer that question in the form of 006.
But if you actually look at the curves are not absolutely convincing.
Correct.
And they didn't present a formal interaction analysis.
Correct.
So
lots of qualifiers here.
Yeah.
Just to throw out a couple of common questions about adjuvant Herceptin before we get back to the hormonal therapy and this lady. We were talking about dose-dense therapy before, George. A very common question is, what about dose-dense AC paclitaxel with trastuzumab?
Well, I don't use it. Is it likely to be safe? Yeah, it's probably likely to be safe. But again, we don't have any data. I think, however, probably the more interesting question is if you look at the joint analysis and look what we've done in the joint analysis with the regimen that we had rather than a dose-dense regimen, distant disease-free survival at 4 years is 90% for the arm getting trastuzumab, 85% for disease-free survival, including local regional recurrences. It's going to be difficult, and this is a problem not just for dose densification, but for a lot of things. It's going to be increasingly difficult actually to even study this population to look for major differences. And I don't know that we're going to be able to find an answer for the dose densification question in the subpopulation of HER2-positive patients. Now, I mentioned earlier that in 97-41, we still haven't seen a breakout of triple negatives versus HER2-positives for dose densification. Actually, I think that's going to be really fascinating to look at. Of course, that's a subset of a subset, but interesting.
What about the Memorial pilot data looking at that presented at San Antonio?
Well, it's pilot data. I think reasonable evidence of safety, but again, the question is, are we going to see any difference in efficacy?
Peter, what's your thought on this?
I look carefully at that poster, and they were only halfway through their accrual, and the median follow-up on the patients was, I think, still something like 6 months. So it was really too early to make any claims about safety. They hadn't seen anything really bad, but I think that they weren't making any claims that the study was anywhere near complete in a way that would allow you to claim safety.
I guess what we could say is that dose-dense AC followed by T doesn't appear any more cardiac toxic than AC followed by T Q3 week. But if you add trastuzumab in the mix, does that change things? We just simply don't know at present.
Peter, what about the issue of delayed trastuzumab? We've become much more sensitive to the time course of recurrence now in breast cancer because of the studies of delayed aromatase inhibitors. What about the patient is a year, 2, 5 years down the line? where you can estimate that the patient still has a residual high risk of relapse with HER2-positive disease. Would you discuss trastuzumab?
My opinion about this has actually changed over time. The big North American trials, the arms that have been emphasized have been the arms that were shared between the NSABP and the intergroup trial. And those are the arms in which the trastuzumab was given concurrently with a taxane portion of the chemotherapy. And those are the arms where the effect was a 50% reduction in recurrence. The arm that hasn't had the same degree of press is the arm that only the intergroup study had, in which all chemotherapy was given and then the trastuzumab was started. And in that arm, there was only about a 15% reduction in the risk of relapse. In other words, it was dramatically less. Now, that result flies in the face of the HERA trial, in which, of course, all the patients started their trastuzumab after their chemotherapy. But the chemotherapy was different in the HERA trial. For the most part, it was not an anthracycline taxane-based regimen. And in fact, if you look at the subset analysis in the HERA trial, those patients that had received both an anthracycline and a taxane as part of their adjuvant therapy, they only had about a 22% benefit, proportional benefit from the therapy. So I think there's still quite an open question as to whether or not the major impact of trastuzumab is by sensitizing the tumor to concurrent chemotherapy, and the effects of trastuzumab given alone are relatively small.
George, 40-year-old woman comes in, had 5 positive nodes 3 years ago.
Yeah. There's an old saying that hard cases make bad law, and that's certainly a hard case. Is that a patient who still is at risk for relapse due to having HER2-positive, lymph node-positive disease? Sure. Do we have any data? No. One can always argue by analogy from hormonal therapy, where we actually do have randomized trials, a couple European trials, I believe, one Italian and one French, where delayed hormonal therapy actually did have a benefit for ER-positive patients. But those arguments by analogy are flawed for the reasons Peter has already mentioned. Hormonal therapy and trastuzumab-based therapies are different in terms of what they do biologically. A lot of the benefit with trastuzumab-based therapy may well be as an amplifier of chemotherapy-induced apoptosis or as an anti-survival factor in a sublethally damaged breast cancer cell. So I'd say we don't know. I'm very uncomfortable about offering that therapy to those patients because I can't tell the patient that I can justify any benefit.
80-year-old lady who has 2 positive nodes, very frail, really doesn't like the idea of chemotherapy, and is ER/PR negative. Would you consider trastuzumab alone?
Well, see, I live in Indiana. All those patients have moved to Florida. So... Well, certainly the HERA trial says that trastuzumab after adjuvant chemotherapy reduces progression-free survival. So, however, there were remarkably few patients on the HERA trial who had no chemotherapy. So we have no data on this. I would be very uncomfortable telling the patient that we had any data to justify it.
Peter?
I think that most of the patients we're seeing today are node-negative patients. It has to be remembered also that most of the patients who are HER2-positive actually tend to have early recurrences within the first 5 years. So the more time that's passed, the less enthusiasm that you're going to be actually working against the peak of recurrence. So I think it's a slippery slope to start treating those patients. And most patients, I wouldn't even consider it. And I think the two things that would drive you toward considering it are multiple nodes, like 10 or more positive nodes, in relatively short interval. In those patients, I think it's worth discussing the situation with. But for the average patient who is node negative or is several years out, even if she was HER2 positive, I wouldn't even consider it.
What about trastuzumab without chemotherapy up front, again, in the elderly, frail, you don't want to give chemo kind of patient?
I don't have any enthusiasm for doing that. Partly because those patients are also the very patients who are most at risk for cardiac issues. Although without an anthracycline, perhaps that's low risk as well.
George, can you tell us your take on the TCH data, the BCRG006? You asked Dennis Lehman in the group, and they say there was no statistically significant difference. Both that and the AC docetaxel were better than the non-trastuzumab, and they can't tell the difference. And yet, they put the slide up and the curve sort of right in the middle.
Our eyes certainly can fool us. I mean, the statistical answer at present is that both of the trastuzumab-containing arms is better than the non-trastuzumab containing arm. That is what the statisticians tell us right now. Now, what the statisticians will tell us a year or two from now may be something totally different, and certainly looking at those curves, it would not surprise you if the AC followed by TH arm is going to be the arm that will come out on top. I must say personally that that was a major disappointment to me. I would love to have a non-anthracycline trastuzumab-based regimen. Based on the data we've got, when we do have these patients with borderline cardiac status, I do feel comfortable offering a patient a non-anthracycline-based regimen. Not the 80-year-old, but say this 64-year-old who's got an ejection fraction of 49% and a history of long-standing hypertension. That's certainly a patient I'd feel reasonably comfortable putting on carb tax trastuzumab based on the data that we have currently.
Dr. Hendricks, can you talk about what kind of therapy you gave her and what you're thinking about right now?
Well, she's prospective, so she just started chemotherapy as if she was on arm C of 9831, which I think everyone would agree with. The issue, though, going back to the infertility, her parents, just prior to her chemotherapy, and you can imagine she saw many medical oncologists, took her to an infertility specialist who really disagreed with the use of ovarian function suppression, telling her that he didn't think that there was going to be adequate protection of her future fertility with the use of Zoladex or Lupron. He actually encouraged her to undergo an ova-harvest procedure and intended to use letrozole. You know, now they use an aromatase inhibitor as one of the harvesting agents, so I wasn't opposed to that. In the end, she declined it and agreed to start her chemotherapy because the clock was ticking and she's anxious. But what disturbed me, he did tell her that he thought that she would have, quote, the ovaries of a 42-year-old at the end of her adjuvant regimen, and that frightened her, and of course it's a big concern for her parents. So the ovarian function suppression is still very much in my mind, and I certainly would offer it to her as an endocrine therapy. I think it's a good agent for her, but this is just a big concern for this woman in her 20s. Breast cancer in the 20s is quite a bit different than in the 30s. Right. So I was a little, we've got this monkey wrench of an infertility specialist weighing in, and it's made it more complicated.
Actually, I have to say that one of the situations where I think I've had patients cry, and most patients don't cry, is if you talk with them about the possibility that they are not going to be able to have a family. Because a lot of people actually have put that off but never entirely closed the door on the idea. And you're 35 and all of a sudden you're facing this. The one question I wanted to ask about this case is that it's important to remember that the gene testing is not always informative. And that there are programs that project what the probability is that you have a genetic defect. And just because the BRCA1 and BRCA2 coding sequences don't have a problem doesn't mean that you don't have a genetic defect. And so I think that she may not have one of the classic Ashkenazi mutations, but if she's got a bunch of female relatives who are in their 20s getting breast cancer, the idea of having a lumpectomy versus a bilateral mastectomy is something to be thought about.
What about her ovaries?
Well, I think that that's an issue, although for some of these variants, exactly what they do to your ovarian risk, I would ask a geneticist. But I would probably talk to her geneticist about what actually it was, because she may have been told that the tests were negative, but she still had a huge risk. And you can't tell somebody that they don't have genetic risk.
Just to follow up, two affected members of this kindred were tested and had comprehensive testing at Baird, which were negative. So what happened was a serum sample has been sent to Mary Claire King's lab because they're looking for cryptic rearrangements. So this kindred is being investigated.
So she had the full chromosome?
Yeah, comprehensive. Two of the affected
had... Not just the Ashkenazi deletions?
They had multi-site 3, were reflexed to comprehensive, and now I think it is worthwhile for this family to be evaluated either for P53 or for a cryptic rearrangement in BRCA1 and BRCA2.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I think one thing you probably would say is that she's probably not BRCA1.
Too young.
Positive. No, actually, not too young. She's HER2 positive. The vast majority of BRCA1s are triple negatives.
Interesting. Dr. Gwynne, you had a question?
She's 27, so her risks of dying from this disease are very high.
You know, interestingly enough, if you take a look at that, after you've accounted for other variables, like whether or not she's HER2 positive, and those kinds of things, she doesn't have much more additional risk. There's probably a 1.5-fold multiplier, but the perception that younger patients, there's something magically different about these people that puts them at high risk, is actually a misperception. These people tend to have higher grade tumors. They tend to be HER2 positive. They tend to be more likely ER/PR negative. So they tend to have more aggressive tumors. But when you know the character of the tumor and the presentation, these patients really don't do markedly worse. That was a surprise to me, actually looking at the SEER data. And actually, the British Columbian data worked out a little bit differently, but it was a 1.5-fold difference. And so I think you need to think of younger patients as somewhat higher risk, but not to multiply the risk by like 3 or 4-fold at what you think.
Now, sometimes we see patients that are HER2 new positive is very borderline. And, you know, it's a cutoff at 2. So I had a patient this week who was 58 years old, fairly small cancer, 1 positive node, though, and the HER2 new was ratio of 2.03. We seem to hardly ever talk about the ratio and how important it is. I know when I see ratio 9 or 8 or 7, I know that's real, but I sometimes wonder in the ones that are just a little over 2, is that the same biology?
Peter?
I think that there are times when immunohistochemistry is useful. And I think that if you have borderline amplification but no overexpression, that would make me suspicious that you really didn't have the target. And so I think that's one place where you might actually have FISH data and then go back. You know, there are situations where you don't have amplification, where you can have overexpression. For instance, you can amplify the entire chromosome, and those people will respond because then you have the centromere and the HER2 area both amplified at the same time. So I would be interested in actually seeing those numbers, but I've never seen low-level FISH scores correlated with it. I wouldn't be surprised if the data didn't exist because so often FISH is one of those things that really is an on-off signal.
George, is there a correlation between the degree of amplification and response to trastuzumab?
Well, certainly not well documented. Anecdotally, one hears that there is a relationship between FISH copy and likelihood of response, but it's certainly exceptionally poorly documented in the literature at this point. It always makes sense when you say that the more target you have, the greater the likelihood you are to have benefit. I think that's eminently reasonable. Now, having said that, there are clearly patients with 2-fold amplification who respond to trastuzumab.
What about Peter's thought in terms of integrating the IHC?
Well, I think it's certainly a reasonable thing to do. IHC, of course, has all of its own set of issues with regard to quality control, quality assurance, which antibody you use, what you call as a positive. Is the IHC on a routine basis likely to overrule a FISH result? To my mind, probably not.